from WYPR.
And PRX.
In collaboration with the West Virginia Folklife Program.
It's Out of the Blocks.
One neighborhood.
Everybody's story.
Everybody's story.
Charleston is a big, small town.
Yeah, you wouldn't walk down street in New York City or in D.C. saying hi to everybody. Okay, but you do that here in Charleston and in West Virginia.
We just find it more comfortable here. It's not so pushy and it's not so busy.
You talk to some people, it's a wonderful place. You talk to me and the people that I've been working with for 40 years, and they would say it's a hard place if you're black, and it's doubly hard if you're poor, and it's triply hard if you're black. You think with your own mind, you have your own ideas, if you were willing to stand up and speak truth to power.
From producers Aaron Hankin and Wendell Patrick.
With West Virginia State folklorist Emily Hilliard.
Out of the Blocks.
Charleston, West Virginia's West Side.
Right after this.
She's getting sauce on the sides ready. My son is dropping wings. We got all the sides ready. Baked beans, collard greens, sweet potato casserole, cabbage, green beans, mac and cheese, potato salad, and coleslaw.
What can or can't you tell me about the sauce?
It's a secret. That's what I can tell you about the sauce.
We on the west side of Charleston, them two brothers and a grill. Adrian Wright.
Ashley Wright. I am Adrian Wright's daughter.
All the meat is out on the grill. Used to be an old propane tank, been cut into to make a grill. We got two racks. You got the bottom rack, the higher rack. You move the meat up before it can slow cook.
The best smelling corner in Charleston.
We got chicken breasts, pulled pork on here. We got ribs on here, getting ready for our lunch rush.
The average day of work is just coming out here, filling at home, and cooking on the grill.
This is Ron, grill man.
You got the rest of the crew working inside in the kitchen. You're outside every day.
Yeah, in the cold, just getting it done.
But I guess you're right next to a pretty major heat source here with the smoker.
Yeah, it feels good. Actually, it warms me up, keeps me crispy all day.
Who's this guy?
This is a neighborhood dog. I was actually just telling him about him. He comes every morning. So he gets the scraps, he might get a pulled pork bone or a rib bone, so, and he'll take it and they'll like run off, so.
He looks very well fed. He's a very well fed pit bull. He's tearing it up, bones and everything.
I think he's got the best meal in town compared to the other dogs.
Well, I grew up right here in Charleston, West Virginia. Played a little football in high school 1 year. Ended up winning the player of the year at Virginia Union. Then I signed with New York Giants, and then I caught on with the Bucks. I was with the Bucks for 3 years. Stayed down there for 26, lived in Tampa. Moved back when I came home to see my mother, and I seen she was having problems. So she had dementia, so I started, had me a grill and a hot dog cart, put it on this corner over here, and the rest is history. It just took off from there. So, matter of fact, she's still living. She's 90 years old. Just turned 90 in August. And she lived with me, and I take care of her. So I stayed and never went back. As a kid, I loved to cook. And I'd be in the kitchen with my mother, even though I played basketball, football out. But, you know, I love cooking. And never did go to culinary school or nothing, but helped me pay my way through college. You know, when you're in college, you need a little extra money. So I used to sell barbecue to the football players and everybody on Sundays. You know, so it just was something I love to do. This ain't work to me. This is fun. It ain't work. I can do it all day. I was told that this barbecue place wouldn't work over here on the west side because, you know, it's basically a trouble area. But the same people who told me it wouldn't work come every day, you know. And, you know, the best thing that happened to me was my two kids moved up here from Florida to help me with this business.
When I was younger, I remember telling him that I did not want to work in barbecue. I don't want to smell like smoke. So that is one thing that he never really lets me live down. But that was just it. I've seen him do this a couple of times, and it's just amazing to watch how his hometown basically embraced him.
To build this thing and see it grow, you know, we're going in our 10th year now, and it's just been good.
I'm going to sing a little bit of a Merle Haggard tune. Silver wings, shining in the sunlight, roaring engine, headed somewhere in flight. They're taking you away and leaving me lonely. Silver wings slowly fading out of sight. My name is Cindy Bird. We're here at Westside Jamboree in Charleston, West Virginia. This is a great place to come and bring your family and dance and listen to the bands. There's different bands every week, and it's really a joy to come out and entertain the people.
Cindy, fantastic entertainer. But yeah, there's a lot of talent in the state of West Virginia. A lot of talent. My name is Jack Dunlap, and I am the leader of the Outlaw Country Band. This is a family-oriented thing. We do it every weekend. As you can see, we have a good crowd, and we always do. And everybody that walks in that door is family. Everybody. And I've always said that if you can put a smile on somebody's face or bring a tear to somebody's eye through a song, then it's worth it all. It's worth it all.
It's amazing. It really is that they recognize the songs. That means we're probably playing them right. That's always a good thing, you know. And as soon as they hear the first note, usually they just flock to the dance floor. It's their favorite song, you know. I'm Steve Mullins. I play fiddle with this six-piece band, I think it is, tonight. And this is a nonprofit that we're playing here at. It's all this money that we make is donated to families that burn out or have lost one of their loved ones and can't pay the funeral bill and things like that. That's what this place does.
And every time I've ever asked the guys to do a benefit for a certain person or a certain organization, then they always come through. And so does this crowd. They always come through.
And these people are not, most of them aren't married. This is a place for elders to come here and get together, you know. And if you've lost someone, then it's a perfect venue for coming in and meeting someone else. Because these girls aren't, they're not a bit afraid to walk up and say, "Hi, my name is so-and-so. Would you like to dance?" You know, they're pretty devious, too. They watch when someone breaks up and they'll go get their man. It's funny to stand up on stage and watch all this go on, but it's amazing, really.
Yeah, there's a lot of single ladies here. Some of them were divorced. Some have lost their husbands. But everybody's willing to dance. I think I've had 13 tonight.
13 different dances?
13 different dances, and I'm about shot. I think I'm about to go home. I'm Daryl Brown. I come up here Friday and Saturday night. The wife was coming up with women in the group, and she got to where she learned to dance and really liked it. So she told me we're going to have to learn to dance. Well, you know how that goes. You know, the lady talks, you listen. So we took a few lessons around the valley here and really got interested in it. And we've been doing that ever since. She now has dementia and can't dance. But she tells me I can dance with anybody I want as long as I go home with her.
You're late to the dancing game, but you're a longtime musician.
That's right, the harmonica. I just play a little tune.
You're in good shape for 86 years old.
Well, thanks.
What's your secret?
Never drank, never smoked. I think that has a lot to do with it. But I've got a good wife, and it's enjoyable to just be around her. And we've had a good life. Couldn't ask for better.
I always feel like everyone I meet, I like to consider my teacher for the day, like, "What, you got any words of wisdom for me about life? I'm all ears."
You learn to say yes, ma'am, and I'm sorry real early in marriage, and it works. I'm living proof of it.
Teresa Brown. We are at the Second Avenue Neighborhood Center, and we are during homework hour right now.
Here. We are here today.
H-E-R-E.
Here, like I hear a strange noise.
H-E-A-R.
You are surrounded by six kids. You're helping six kids with six different homework assignments all at once.
Exactly.
My name is McKayden, and I go to school at Mercy Snow. I'm 9 years old. I'm in fourth grade, and I like study art and math and reading and stuff.
It sounds like Ms. Teresa helps a lot of people in the neighborhood, yeah? How would you describe Ms. Teresa?
Like a good person, but sometimes, like, I play around, and sometimes I have to sit down and stuff. But she helps a lot of people, and
she's a good person.
I love these kids, and I give them everything I got.
Our Father in heaven.
Our Father in heaven.
Hallowed be thy name.
Hallowed be thy name.
Well, this program got started back in 2001 when the city of Charleston shut the building down, and our pastor, Reverend James Ely, took the building over, and I stepped in and been running it ever since, free of charge.
It just keeps a good thing going. At one time, I think we had about 150 kids in the after-school program. Reverend James Ely, and back in 2000, this was headquarters central for the drug problem in West Virginia. And so we decided we were going to go out and take our ministry to the street. And so then the city decided to give us this building because the drug folk had taken over. So we decided we were going to try and break it up. And we still got a long way to go, but we really did accomplish an awful lot. And so that's how we ended up with this building.
I love Reverend Ely, and he knows I have his back. He's a wonderful man. If it wasn't for him, there would be no me. I'm going to tell you that right now. I was a hot mess. I was the mess in the street that he came out and saved. And I appreciate that from the bottom of my heart. And let's see how long. I've worked for him for 20 years, unpaid. So I got to have some kind of love for him, huh?
I learned something important about this group, and that has to do with a decision you all made about whether or not you were going to take funds for that. I wonder if you could explain the importance of spirituality in what you're doing and the dedication you have to keeping this a spiritual-based program.
We were coming up for an audit, so we're getting this money from the city, and I'm saying, well, a wonderful thing to do is to invite the people in while we're feeding the kids, you know, and for a lot of the kids, this was the meal of the day for them, and so we just thought this was going to be great for the people to see us feeding the kids and all. And when they would line up and they would have to say a Bible verse and then offer prayer. When they prayed, you know, the people that were doing the audit, then they said, Reverend, now you know you can't make them pray. And I'm saying, well, this is who we are. If you want to keep your money, you keep your money and we'll make do. So we've been making it.
I'm not going to compromise who I am and what I believe over someone else's money.
For yours is the kingdom.
For yours is the kingdom.
And the power.
And the power.
And the glory.
And the glory.
Forever and ever, amen.
Forever and ever, amen.
This is yours, to put it in your book bag. You tripping. I don't
need that. Okay, well, I guess you're gonna need some more. There's so much junk in here, you can't see anything. Here's a projector that I rebuilt. And here's where you would project through this. And then you had these rollers to film, guided them here so that you didn't have any weave or anything.
Tell me your full name.
Donald Moore. Company here is called Moore Theater Equipment.
You know, we put in new theaters from scratch. We converted, we added screens, and my father and I started it in 1962. He passed away in 1966, and I've been in it all these years, 53 to be exact.
Do you remember what the first movie is you ever went and saw in a theater when you were a kid?
Well, see, my dad had 15 theaters at one time, so I saw a lot of movies. It was probably some of the old westerns, Roy Rogers and Gene Autry, and the industry was all cowboys and Indians, basically. There was a few horror pictures, a few mysteries and what have you, but predominantly it was all that, you know.
Tell me about your growing up under your dad's wing and going and actually learning what he did, how he did what he did, and learning it for yourself.
Yeah, I would help him and stuff, watch and learn and what have you, and I'd always get the scrub jobs, you know, clean up this mess, clean up that mess, before you could work on it, you know, so greasy and dirty. But I learned a lot, and it was interesting, and he was born in Portsmouth, Ohio. He only had a sixth grade education. He went to work in the theater as a projectionist when he was 12, 13 years old. The reason he had to quit school is he had a younger brother and sister that he had to help take care of and what have you. And he says, you know, it was really tough and winters were bad. He said he had a little old broke down wagon and he'd go out and walk the railroad tracks and pick up coal and take it back and they'd burn that for heat.
He went from being a teenage projectionist helping to pay his family's budget to an entrepreneur who ended up owning 15 movie theaters.
Yeah, he did. And they were all in coal camps, basically. They did what they called bicycling film back then. You'd bring a movie in and you'd show it at this theater here. And then once it showed there and everybody seen it, they moved it to the other theater and they moved a new one in here. So one movie went around for 15 weeks to all the whole, what they called the circuit. You take one out, you put a new one in, and they all just made a circle.
When did you officially go out of business?
1st of January. I'm 70 years old. And when digital came along, it just changed the whole world. Yeah, I guess it's like, you used to play baseball all your life, and then all of a sudden start playing basketball or soccer or something different, and it's just not the same animal that it was. You know, it's just totally different.
What's the future of this space and all the stuff in it at this point?
Well, I mean, I'm hoping the lawyer next door will want to buy the building and tear it down and make a parking lot. I don't need it anymore. It served its purpose as far as I'm concerned. It was a good living. If you can stay in business for 53 years, that says a lot.
It's out of the blocks.
Charleston, West Virginia, West Side.
One neighborhood.
Everybody's story.
Everybody's story.
Everybody's story.
My name is Fran Gray. We're currently at Recovery Point in Charleston, located on the west side. It is a 9 to 12 month absence-based program. Our participants live here the entire time. There's multiple parts of the program. There's detox, there's OTS-1, there's OTS-2, phase 1, and then a 3 month aftercare portion. And they are not allowed to leave until we actually have an approved home plan for them. We currently have 111 girls in the main facility. We have an 8-bedroom house right next across the street, and then we have a 24 complex apartment out back. So there's typically about 146 women here at any time. I was actually a participant here back in 2016. I was the first graduate of this program. So I started out from detox, and I've kind of worked my way up to the director's position now. It's really comforting to talk to someone and be like, me too, I've been there too, exactly where you're at. Most of the women don't believe that I'm in recovery, and I like that. They think that you know, they can just see that my life's gotten significantly better and can't, you know, in that state of mind, imagine. I came from a small town. There was no drinking, no drugs in my house. No one even smoked. I got into a car accident back in 2012, 10, and I was prescribed opiates at that time and put on a lot of drip and morphine, and I had never used any type of opiates in my entire life. I had no idea that you could even get addicted. I was actually very judgmental towards people that had addiction. I always imagined that person as like the hobo under the bridge drinking a bottle. That's how I thought it. You know, I always did really well in school, had scholarships, everything else to go to college. But when I got into college after my car accident, after the opiates were gone, I started drinking because I kind of started remembering like that feeling with it. I had lost my job at that point. I had lost my scholarship, so it just kind of went off from there. I ended up getting with a boy that was using at the same time too, and I was trying to save him essentially from it. I remember actually yelling at him to get up and suck it up because he was going through detox, because I just didn't understand. And at that point, I don't know, I just got to the point where I wanted to try to see what he was choosing over me. And from there, it just went off. I used IV heroin. First time I ever used heroin was IV, and I was instantly addicted. I used IV for about 18 months, and then what ended up happening is I got into trouble. I had a petty larceny charge. So, you know, I was looking at a situation where I was looking at 10 years in prison. From there, I was given a choice. I could either go to treatment, or I could stay in jail for a really long time. And so then November 14th, 2016, I came here. So I went through here and graduated and took a program honor position here. And recently, about 5 months ago, I moved into the director's position. I've actually, you know, working through here and finding myself, I learned a way to choose me. And I, you know, I have a new relationship today. And I actually had my daughter too while I've been in sobriety, and who's absolutely wonderful. I swear she's like the best baby ever. And I don't know, I've got to be not only stable in my family's life now and not worry my mother to death and my father to death. You know, I've been able to build my own family from there too. You know, I'm stable now. I own a house. I mean, that's something that, you know, has been a great achievement of mine. And, you know, to be a really good mom has been another achievement of mine.
Well, I'm a native West Virginian, born and raised in the southern West Virginia coal fields in Fayette County. But I've lived here for 40 years, actually. My name is Matthew J. Watts. I'm the senior pastor and teacher of the Grace Bible Church of Charleston. And so when I became the senior pastor of the Grace Bible Church, I persuaded the church for us to move to the west side of Charleston, that the need there was great because of the challenges and the fact that it has the highest concentration of African Americans that live anywhere in the state of West Virginia was another pull for me to come to the west side. I think what it's up against is a history that is couched in slavery, discrimination, marginalization, exclusion, and exploitation. The West Side was established as 5 slave plantations, places like Hunt Avenue, where the Hunt were slave owners. Corey Street, a major street downtown, is also part of the West Side, slave owners. Summer Street, slave owners. The Patrick Street Bridge, slave owners, right? And that history basically was totally ignored. No one talked about it. And so it helped us to begin to educate the community how to counter, to offset 155 years of history that's laid down like shellac in layers, right? I walk a lot. That's why I got this, you know, walking suit on, right? I had this heart attack last year. Now I'm serious about my health and so forth. I see the pain of poor people. I see the pain of black people in particular. My wife and I moved in on the street at the time. It was the toughest street on the west side of Charleston about 6 years ago. I feel led to do that because I feel like I've got to feel the pain of the people. Their pain got to become my pain. Their problem got to become my problem, because if it is, I'll be more creative, more disciplined, more determined, and more resolved. I'm more courageous to try to do something about it. And so by the time I get to the pulpit on Sunday morning, I know that some of my people experience that pain as well. And so I look out on my congregation, and I see them out there. And I know the people whose son is in prison. I know the grandmother lived across the street who's raising her granddaughters because her daughter has her problem. And what I see in my congregation, I see incredible resiliency. We have kids in our church that have been dealt a tough hand. You know, some of them, fathers in prison. Some of the fathers haven't been are dead. Some of my kids don't know who their fathers are. But they're going to school every day. And they're trying, right? And they're solid citizens in school. And they have every reason to say, I'm mad at the world, right? And be wreaking havoc within the school system. And we just got the report cards, and we're just so excited because they all did well. Their resolve also motivates me in terms of the human spirit. So you keep trying to do the best you can every day.
It is what it is. You know, it's a two-bedroom with a single bath and a full basement, so it can accommodate a family of four relatively easy. You see, we had to strip the walls down because they were plaster, and they had old metal windows in. Then we took those out and put in new vinyl windows. We're redoing all the plumbing, all the water supply lines anyway, and maybe some of the drainage work might have to be redone. My name is Bob Hardy. I'm the executive director of Charleston Economic Community Development Corporation, which is in this neighborhood to improve the quality of affordable housing.
What do you estimate is the vacancy rate in this neighborhood right about now?
Probably about 40 to 60%. And the reason it's that low is because a lot of houses have been torn down. Housing is the key. And right now we're trying to create an opportunity where people can not only have safe, decent, affordable housing, but they'll be able to buy the houses because the investment that you have in a house is the greatest investment that you're going to have. Trying to find decent home buyers or renters is maybe one of the most difficult situations that you get into. For one thing, when you deal with low-wealth people, they don't have the confidence that they'll be able to borrow money. So we try to see if there's any subsidy funding, something that will help buy the mortgage down. If we can rehab a house for $70,000, it's better than building a new house that's going to cost $100,000 or $125,000, because then you can get the mortgage rates down to what people can afford. I grew up on the hill, so the west side is like my front yard. And my dad, being a former school teacher and stuff, during the summer, you know, when he wasn't teaching, his main theme for me and my three brothers, y'all keep this yard clean. So, you know, over the years, I just grew to think of the west side as my front yard. So you just got in my blood to try to do something to make it better or bring it back to what it was when I was a youth. And that's taken me since 1994 up to today. But we still suffer from disinvestment from the powers that be. And until that investment comes to the forefront, we're going to struggle. We've made some progress, and I think we're headed in the right direction. Just how much longer is it going to take?
Skepticism is there for a reason, and I think the best we can do today is to listen to people and to say, okay, what would you do, you know, if you were in my shoes? My name is John Butterworth. I'm a neighborhood planner with the City of Charleston Planning Department. Urban renewal of the 60s and 70s and 80s was very sort of master plan based, right? They kind of depicted this whole, you know, we're going to take this whole city block and knock down this house and renovate this house and displace poor Miss Johnson and what, you know, whatever it was. That's not the way redevelopment happens, at least not these days. It's much more organic with a land reuse program that we're trying to build now. We want to be able to respond to you know, abandonment when it occurs, right? So if someone walks off from a property, we want to intervene. But if they don't, let's figure out how to keep them there and make their lives better. So I think that sort of nimble approach where you know, we're not trying to master plan a community. We're not trying to tell them who they need to be. We're trying to respond to instances of blight where they happen. And if that's a, you know, a house that tragically catches on fire and needs to be demolished because it's, you know, mostly burned, we need to jump in. If it's a vacant lot that the house is long gone, you know, right now we're working on big ideas about how we try to make reinvestment the right choice there. when I look at map of the West Side, you know, I see all the data nerd stuff where you have blight condition surveys and census tracts and zoning districts and all the things that city planners geek out about. But the most effective thing that I've ever done is hopped in someone's car and they said, I need to go show you something, and go for a ride, and you will learn more in that hour or two than you can. I'm a data nerd. I love maps. I can dig into census data with the best of them, but riding around in somebody's pickup truck that's got a bullet hole in the tailgate, that's how you understand a neighborhood, and is one of the things that I hope makes me better at my job.
You've got bales of clothes that are like 15 feet high here.
Yeah, people will buy those by the pound, and that money goes right back into our program. My name is Essie Yolanda Jackson, and we are at Goodwill Industries of the Kanawha Valley on the west side of Charleston, West Virginia.
And you guys are intaking clothing that goes to a lot of different Goodwill stores then all over the region.
Yes, we have 20 counties just in this surrounding area.
And then over here in the other room is, it looks like a massive sorting operation going on here.
It is, in fact, that's exactly what it is. So this is where people can learn about being detail-oriented.
I take clothes off the rack. I sweep the floors, unload and load trucks. My name is Billy Carter. Wanted to do better in life and get on the right track. And I talked to her about it, and I ended up here, and it's been good so far, you know. Sometimes she gets on my nerves, but Essie's a good woman.
He is one of our standouts. He has been through our soft skills class, and he's one of my favorites because I get to pop him upside the head sometimes.
There's been a little difficulties learning, adjusting, and learning a bunch of stuff, but she's always there to lift me when I'm down, so it's all good, all joy.
Most people think of Goodwill only as secondhand clothing shops, but really, all of the work that everyone does here is supported by this operation, this warehouse that we're standing in right now. Yeah?
Yeah, we are supported by our retail operations, and so that includes here, everything here feeds into the stores, feeds into people coming in, buying stuff from the stores, feeds back into our program. So this is my classroom. I teach all of our career development courses here. I do curriculum development, lesson planning, all of that other good stuff. We look at the 7 soft skills clusters. We mostly concentrate on the functional resume. We try to arrange interviews for them, mock interviews, real interviews here on site, and they're evaluated on things like eye contact, posture. So that way, as we're continuing to work together, I'll know what areas to focus on when we're working. My students are people from different backgrounds. So I've got people with disabilities, people coming in after incarceration, young people just starting out. And so you know that if they weren't in this place together, they probably would never meet. It's an amazing thing. It's probably my favorite part of the job, is just watching them go from complete strangers to supporting one another.
It gives me guidance and structure, because I'm waking up at 6:30 in the morning, preparing myself to be out the door by 7:30, and looking forward to being around my peers and learning the assignment for the day. And it makes me feel personally like a better person.
After he finishes our 60-day paid training program here, he will also be finishing up in our Good Host program, and right there is where we jumpstart his career, because we have an idea of what he's good at, what he's interested in, and that sort of thing. So this is his time to get ready before I push him out of the nest.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Out of the Blocks.
From radio producer Aaron Hinken.
And music producer Wendell Patrick.
Special thanks to West Virginia State folklorist Emily Hilliard.
And the West Virginia Folklife Program. at the West Virginia Humanities Council.
You can podcast this series. Check out photos online
at wypr.org/out of the blocks.
Aaron and Wendell want to thank all of us
who took a leap of faith and shared our stories and our lives.
For WYPR and PRX,
this is Charleston, West Virginia, West Side.
Signing off.
Coming up next time on Out of the Blocks, we're back on the West Side in Charleston, West Virginia for some more great stories. We're going to meet a local barber, a community gardener, an antique collector, a symphony clarinetist, and a basketball legend. We're also going to visit an auto shop, a local carryout store, a Girl Scout troop, and a neighborhood elementary school that's got a dedicated staff, including these two, who not only work together, they are housemates too.
Hey, Axel, come here. Come. My name's Walter Tucker. I'm one of the musical directors here at Mary C. Snow Westside Elementary, and I'm Axel's handler, which is our therapy dog. He travels to all the classrooms with our counselor, so he gets the opportunity to interact with all the children here in the school. Yep, he's sniffing the mic right now. One student of ours that was coming in the morning, autistic student, he would cry every morning, and when he would come down the hallway and he would see Axel, he would stop crying. So every morning that student would come down, just spend like 5 minutes with him, and then he would stop crying and he'd be ready to go back to class.
Good boy. Yep. Oh, there we go. Tired pup.
I call him my little bear.
Axel, the therapy dog at Mary C. Snow Westside Elementary School, and more next time on Out of the Blocks. Special thanks this episode to the NEA, the National Endowment for the Arts, whose support makes it possible to bring Out of the Blocks to Charleston and other towns across the U.S. Thanks also to you for taking the time to listen. If you appreciate what you hear on this program, do us a favor and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, or just tell a friend. Thanks for listening. Thanks for spreading the good word about this podcast, and we'll do it again soon. Out of the Blocks is supported by PRX and produced with grant funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Maryland State Arts Council, the Hofberger Foundation, Patricia and Mark Joseph Shelter Foundation, Inc., the Sana and Andy Brooks Family Fund, the Peel Center, and the William G. Baker Jr. Memorial Fund, creator of the Baker Artist Portfolios, online at bakerartist.org.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.